The saying goes, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But what if you don't have access to fresh produce where you live? Or transportation to the doctor if that apple doesn't work? Or someone to watch your kids while you're at the doctor? Or, you get the point. A person's success in managing their health and wellness may depend much less on what happens inside of a doctor's office than what happens outside of it. There's plenty about where we are born, grow, live, and work, and how these circumstances are shaped by access to resources that influence the health we can achieve. There's a name for it: social determinants of health. So as a community, how might we begin to address these social determinants? How might we make progress towards reducing health disparities and improving health equity? How do we create a future where people receive support to stay well, rather than just treating them when they are sick? It starts with research. It starts with conversations. It starts with listening. It starts with understanding. Supporting people in their journey to good health is part of how we can create a better world. I'm Ellen Beckjord. Good Health, Better World is a show about how stronger communities begin with good health for everyone, even outside the doctor's office. In episode 7, we hear from Congresswoman Robin Kelly of Illinois, as well as Dr. Johanna Vidal-Falan, Senior Medical Director at UPMC Health Plan, and Katie Domalakis, Director of Clinical Programs at UPMC for You.
But first, let's listen to a short field report by Post Industrial Media.
In the early days of motherhood, which I like to oftentimes refer to the dog days of motherhood, moms are really dealing with struggling to take care of themselves. At its most basic core, it has a lot to do with what's happening with moms before they get pregnant, before they have babies. And specifically with Black moms, we're not taking care of ourselves before we have children. So when we have children, at the impetus of a pregnancy or at the end of a pregnancy, it becomes even more difficult to do the self-care, to take care of yourself, to make sure you need everything you need. And that's so much of what Pittsburgh Brown Mamas focuses on, is really trying to give moms opportunities to take a breath and take care of themselves. And one of the things we're always hearing is, I'm exhausted, I'm tired. Being a mom wasn't good today. This wasn't easy today. And I think in those early days of infancy with your child, it's really hard to feel good every day. My name is Muffy Mendoza, and I am the founder of Pittsburgh Brown Mamas, which is a local support group for African-American moms. We pretty much focus on giving moms access to positive socialization outlets, and in the midst of that, giving them the information and resources they need to raise happy, healthy adults, and hopefully to thrive even beyond motherhood. We never had an intention to be a community association, an organization, nothing like that. It was just a group of a few moms who wanted to get together to meet other like-minded moms. We have to start to normalize Black women, period, taking care of themselves. I always like to remind everybody that Black mothers have been the fry cooks, the customer service representatives, the nurses, and every other hard job that you can think of. Those positions are oftentimes done by Black mothers. And so these are the same Black mothers that have toddlers at home, who have to drop their kids off at the after school program, who maybe hasn't had a babysitter in the last 4 or 5 years. So many times what we're seeing is that because Black mothers are not able to take care of themselves properly, that's spilling over into their motherhood journeys, and oftentimes is the reason why we're hearing about so many negative outcomes when it comes to Black birthing. And so a big part of self-care for Black women is just access to right healthcare. Access to healthcare that is more just, access to a healthcare that is not judgmental. If a mother has a doctor that she's afraid to talk to, then she's not able to advocate for herself. And advocating for oneself is a part of taking care of oneself. So I think we have to look at self-care not only as, you know, what you do, you know, when you go get your nails done and getting your hair done, but it's a whole new level of thinking about the ways in which a person is able to take care of themselves. I think we have to understand that supporting mothers in the early days is not something one organization, one company can do. It really takes a village. It takes a bunch of organizations to get together and create that village, along with parents, along with community members, and along with the mother herself. Oftentimes we are expecting one or two people, one or two organizations to do the job that was once done by 10 to 12 people. And so we have to get out of this idea that, you know, maternal care should be siloed to one place. It should be something that we are all taking an active participating role in to make sure that we have healthy moms so that we can have healthy children.
I'm very grateful to have the chance today to talk with two colleagues, Katie Domolakis and Dr. Johanna Vidal-Falon, and would like to welcome both of you to the Good Health, Better World podcast. Thank you for being with us today.
Super excited to be here with you today, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen.
Katie is the Director of Clinical Programs at UPMC Health Plan for the Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program. And Katie, you're a licensed social worker and have dedicated your career at the health plan to improving health equity across populations with a specific emphasis on maternal and child health. Dr. Vidal-Falon, you are our Senior Medical Director for Pediatrics at the health plan, with more than 15 years of clinical experience as a pediatrician and a real leader in population health. My pleasure to have both of you here today to talk about maternal and child health. And so, Katie, if I could start with you. You know that here in Pittsburgh, in our region, we've grappled with making substantial improvements in maternal health. You've both talked about the importance of listening to and learning from families as we try to design services that meet their needs. And I'm thinking about, Katie, some of what I know you've led us in the past 6 to 12 months, which is becoming more mobile in how we deliver services. Can you say a little bit about our mobile services? And has there been an opportunity to get closer to families through use of technology to connect with them face to face in their home environments?
Using technology, becoming more mobile, being more present to women and children in the community really speaks to me as my background as a social worker. I take very seriously the idea of meeting people where they are. And my background here at the health plan has been in Medicaid and CHIP. So we have folks that have a lot of extenuating factors in their lives. So maybe a mom has multiple kiddos, maybe she lives in an area around having a lack of transportation, maybe she works a job that is not a 9-to-5. That makes it really difficult for us to have meaningful conversations. We're doing a lot of phone tag. So I think being mobile has allowed us a couple of great opportunities in being able to understand and walk in the shoes of our families, meeting people in their home is a lot more intimate. It requires a lot more established rapport and trust. It makes us as clinicians, as nurses and social workers, be more mindful and be more present. So I think that allows us to have more accessibility, more availability, and better quality conversations. COVID-19 has derailed our plans to be increasingly mobile and increasingly in homes in 2020, as it has done so much in the Pittsburgh area and the country. So we have been forced to use or think about using technology differently. And we've used our Anywhere Care platform, which is a synchronous video platform. But what we found has been that this platform and being able to see someone has increased engagement with our families. And when I say engagement, not just them picking up, but it's allowed this personal interface. People have been more willing to share. We've had conversations that are more organic, that really speak to the compassion of our nurses and social workers and really get to the needs of a family. And we've noticed that we've had opportunities I don't think we would have had before. We had a case where our nurse care manager, engaged with the family, had actually lost contact for a little bit, and then had re-engaged and found that that family had suffered a tragedy. Their baby had died, and this mom was devastated. And our care manager was able to talk with her, sit with her in her grief, help support her, and then in a asynchronous video, be able to include a behavioral health professional on that call, get her linked to treatment, and help her and her family heal. And I don't think that would have happened in such an intimate and present way had we not been using a telehealth platform, had we been on a phone. So I see that as an example of what is possible. And even when we're able to be more present and close with everyone, there's still a place for that telehealth capacity in our care management services.
I'd love to hear your perspective, because we need to treat or consider synchronous video interactions as fundamentally different than telephonic interactions. But Johanna, I'm curious what you think about the use of synchronous videos in the work that you do as a pediatrician, or even observing what we do at the health plan.
Ellen, that is a wonderful question. And definitely echoing what Katie was just saying, the impact of video engagement is so important. And as we are engaging with our members through, for example, the maternity care management program, and soon the pediatric care management program, there is a connection. I mean, face-to-face is always ideal, but if we can reach our families, not only by telephone, but by connecting with them, assess, you know, the facial features of a mother, be suspicious of postpartum depression or other issues that may be impacting that household, that is very challenging to determine when doing it only by phone. The pandemic has really changed the way we view healthcare. And as a pediatrician who never had the opportunity to do telemedicine until March, and really adopting new technology in new ways, it is amazing. The feedback that we have obtained from our families, they're so excited to see us continue engaging with them in a way that they feel that is safe. They feel that they can ask questions, and they have expressed many times, you know, simple barriers like childcare. I couldn't come to the office because I have 5 children and I can't leave them in the home. But now I can have an appointment, talk about my child's behavior, for example, with all my kids in the same living room. And I think families now have adapted to, you know, having these videos visits, and they actually asking for more. So we definitely need to think of ways to continue accommodating their desires and needs, but also breaking barriers like access, especially in rural areas.
Johanna, can you talk about some of the services that women and families need that maybe aren't considered traditional health services, but that you have observed through your work as a pediatrician, services that may fall outside the realm of traditional healthcare, but are absolutely instrumental to the health and well-being of moms and children?
As a pediatrician in clinical practice, as a parent, it's a common ground in regards to wanting what's best for our children. Not only access to healthcare and well-child visits and immunizations, which of course are critically important, but access to an education, access to the right foods, access to healthcare when it's needed the most, access to behavioral health services, dental services. These are all critical components in the well-being and the growth of our children. And we know that in order for children to be healthy, to be well-adjusted, to do well in life, it's really important that parents are cared for, that they have access to healthcare. And it is too many times when I see moms lose the ability to have healthcare when I know that they need access to behavioral health services because of postpartum depression, or they have complications from breastfeeding. And these are moms that are working either on a part-time basis, or they have multiple jobs, but none of them offer healthcare. So we know that when a mom is not healthy and she has chronic medical conditions from diabetes, hypertension, or mental health issues, even substance abuse disorder, this child that I'm caring for as a pediatrician is not going to do well. So this is why we need to focus not only in increasing access to healthcare to mothers, but also access to these other services that are so important and so essential in the well-being of the family as a whole.
There are a few things that it seems like won't go back to the way they were before the pandemic. And I think one of them is this increased use of telemedicine and driven, as you said, Johanna, by patients and members and families finding so much value in it. And I know there's been legislation and policy changes that have enabled that and that will continue to enable that. And so that's a transition to a question I wanted to ask both of you about legislation, which is the Helping Moms Act. So I know that you both recently spent some time in DC meeting with congressional offices on maternal health and the Helping Moms Act. Johanna, can you say a little bit about that experience?
It was an honor to be able to have these conversations with our political leaders. Very insightful. And as a pediatrician, I was really honored to be able to share of my own clinical experience of what is important for mothers and children. As we know, mothers at this time receiving Medicaid are covered only for the first 60 days postpartum. Unfortunately, that is not enough. And to be able to share the challenges that mothers face when raising their families, so we really were able to share the importance of a comprehensive, good maternal health care and the impact that it not only has on the mother, but on the children. When you treat postpartum depression, it is not only in the first 30 days after the baby is born, it's up to the first year. Mothers also need routine care from contraception to, their annual physicals. And so we need to optimize maternal care to be sure that the next generation of children are receiving the best care possible. And it's something as simple as offering healthcare to moms 1 year postpartum. I know as a country, we can do that. We can deliver this. And I think this is a priority that we all need to push our legislators to pass.
Katie, would you like to add anything about the experiences you had with congressional offices in discussing the Helping Moms Act?
Similar to Dr. Vidal's experience, it was an honor and a privilege to be able to advocate for women and children to have comprehensive health care. One of the biggest issues is that 60-day cutoff. And I think it reflects a really interesting piece when we talk about maternal health care, is that maternal health care is in current state really focused on when mom is pregnant. And we tend to have the postpartum period as an afterthought. When that postpartum period is as equally, if not more important, because we have conditions that might have been identified in pregnancy, such as hypertension or diabetes that still exist postpartum that require comprehensive medical care, as well as the emotional and behavioral health challenges of being a mom and postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. And that's not even to think about on the grander scale of substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, that's really been increasingly prevalent in all populations, but certainly in women across the country. And we see that a lot in our southwestern Pennsylvania, particularly our rural communities. So understanding that we have the ability to treat these things we're identifying during the prenatal period to provide families with stability, to provide families with the best health they can is crucially important. And it is important to realize that that care doesn't end when the baby's born. It is important as a country that we advocate, that we work hard to understand that the healthcare of moms and babies are the building blocks of families. What we do in this time period will be the next generation of folks here in the Pittsburgh region, the next generation of folks here in our country.
I just want to point out that as we talk about it, it's such a no-brainer what the Helping Moms Act is trying to do with even just with respect to the extension of insurance coverage after birth from 60 days to a year. To all of us have children, think back to when our children were newborns. 60 days is just not enough time to hardly do anything. You've barely got your feet underneath you as a new mom. Even if it's not your first child, just with a newborn, it's too short a period of time to ask women to navigate the complexities of the health insurance market and the health care delivery system. We should be supporting them however we can to do that seamlessly. The last question I wanted to ask both of you, and Katie, I'll ask you first. I'd love to hear what you feel particularly hopeful about when it comes to maternal and child health. And then Johanna, would love to hear your perspective too.
I'm particularly hopeful that there is a lot of good work happening in communities. There are many community-based organizations, community advocacy groups, women and families that live in communities that know what they do well, that understand their opportunities and their challenges. And I'm hopeful that we, as an integrated finance and healthcare delivery system, are committed to coming to the table and learning. I think that 2020 has provided guidance on things that we can't really turn away from, things that have already been known to the folks here in this room chatting, but that there are very huge structural health inequities based on race that we must acknowledge, particularly around maternal child health outcomes and the death rates related to race and ethnicity based on COVID-19. And we can start to do something about it. We can start to acknowledge it, name it, and moving to the communities and partnering with them to change it. And I'm hopeful that we're at the point now that we listen. I'm hopeful that we understand that folks navigate the world differently. And I'm hopeful that we use that information to make the changes that we need to.
I'm very hopeful that having these conversations about health disparity is going to lead us to finally improving and recognizing the root cause of these issues, to get us to talk about it, to teach the next generation to address them earlier, and to do something that is going to definitely now and forever change the way we experience health disparities in healthcare. I shared earlier, I'm a Latina physician with almost 20 years of experience, and I really have dedicated my career to serve the underserved. I work in FQAC settings, and I have passionately understood and really faced the challenges that the Hispanic Latinx community face. And nothing has changed. The health disparities and social determinants of health that impacted my community 20 years ago are still here today. So the first step in addressing health disparity is to recognize them and to commit to reducing them. And I'm very fortunate to be part of an organization like UPMC that is talking and addressing them every single day. I see hope. I see future. I know there's a lot of work ahead of us. Sometimes it could be extremely overwhelming. And one thing I have learned, and I realized that this is not the job of only our Black physicians and healthcare leaders, our Hispanic or Black leaders. It's a job that needs to be done by all of us. All of us have to be engaged, regardless of culture, ethnic background, and race, to make this happen. And I've seen the community of healthcare leaders here at UPMC come together to discuss them, to have very difficult conversations, but to come up with solutions. So I'm very hopeful that in the next year to 2 years, we're going to see amazing outcomes. And I'm really happy to be part of this conversation.
Well, I'm very hopeful too, but I do feel particularly hopeful because the efforts are so distributed across kind of every level of the ecosystem, right? All the way from being on the Hill and helping to advocate for federal legislation, all the way down to the individual level there and everywhere in between, which really I think is going to be the way forward. How can we work at so many different levels to address the systemic issues that we know exist around racial inequities in healthcare and health outcomes, all the way down to how do we become more innovative and more impactful in the service that we deliver in culturally competent and person-centered ways. And I always give our guests the final word. Johanna, I will ask you first, and then Katie, anything else you'd like to add for the folks listening to this episode?
I like to add that Ellen is an advocate for addressing disparities here at the health plan. And I would love to hear from you, Ellen, some of the initiatives that you're doing already at the health plan to help health disparities.
I can certainly share some of that. So thank you. I really appreciate your calling that work out. And as you know, right, the whole enterprise, the UPMC, has recently mobilized new collaborations across payer, provider, and corporate to do something like what we just talked about. How can we work at every potential level to improve receipt of care and outcomes for communities of color in the members and the patients that we serve? And most importantly, go into the communities where those inequities are the most apparent and listening to and learning from the individuals who have the lived experience to help us understand and co-design with communities new approaches to reduce health disparities, not just more of the same. More of the same is not going to fundamentally get us to a different place. How do we make sure that we're providing the right level of service to all of our members and doing that through an equity lens, which means some of our members need more help and more service than others? And how can we use equity to guide our efforts for the equitable distribution of the services that we provide to improve maternal and child health outcomes, to help people receive primary care instead of care in the emergency department, to help our members receive the specialist care they may need to manage their chronic conditions, particularly in the area of cardiovascular health. So it's a large effort that has so many important players at the table who are all marching towards the same vision of more equitable receipt of the care we have to offer. And it's been a wonderful set of work to be involved with. And I'm grateful that both of you have been able to participate in that work as well, because it's really taking a village, to be sure. Katie, anything you'd like to add before we close our conversation?
I think one of the next steps from this discussion, and maybe a challenge to everybody listening out there, is some of those non-medical pieces. So I think about what those programs that provide or enhance access look like and how they might need to change. And that all of these things that seem not at all connected, perhaps to a mom giving birth to a full-term baby or to a child getting their vaccinations on time, are very much the pieces that matter. So how do we think about and advocate and have conversations around what are the things that prevent or impede best health? If we think about and challenge ourselves to ask the questions and think about how we create that, those are the pieces that are that will help increase equity, not only for moms and babies, but almost all types of chronic disease burden and communities.
I think another word that people often use to describe that collection of factors are those upstream factors. And we know that in the US, we spend comparatively little of our dollar on upstream factors in healthcare. And that's one of the things that's so exciting about the Helping Moms Act, is that I think it represents a real step forward in using legislative action to shift to more upstream consideration of factors that, as you said, and I think the fact that that's happening more frequently, it's happening here on this podcast, it's happening nationally, is then what's leading to things like the Helping Moms Act come to fruition and really put policy and practice behind those ideas in our pursuit of good health and a better world for everyone. Thank you both so much for being with us today. If you'd like to learn more about the Helping Moms Act or about the services for women and children provided by the UPMC Health Plan, we'll have links to that information in our episode notes. It's such an honor to have Congresswoman Robin Kelly from Illinois join us today on the Good Health, Better World podcast. Congresswoman Kelly has dedicated her career to public service as an advocate for Illinois families. She was elected to serve the 2nd Congressional District in 2013 and has spent her time working on improving the health and wellness of vulnerable communities across the country. She chairs the Congressional Black Caucus Health Brain Trust and co-chairs the Congressional Caucus on Black Women and Girls. You have a PhD in political science. Congresswoman Kelly, Dr. Kelly, it's so wonderful to have you here with us today. Thank you for being on Good Health, Better World.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been representing the 2nd District of Illinois since 2013. If we could start with just a general question, I'm curious about what drew you to public service.
I knew I always wanted to be in public service. I never knew that I would be elected to anything. I always knew I wanted to be in a helping profession, but I never knew it would be as an elected person.
We've typically not thought as much about upstream factors in the context of health and well-being, which is something that makes the Helping Moms Act so incredibly exciting. It is a piece of federal legislation that is aiming to really have an impact on upstream factors related to health and well-being. You're a lead sponsor of this national bipartisan Helping Moms Act.
Sure. Well, maternal mortality is such an issue in this country for all women, but in particular, African-American women and Native women. African-American women die 3 to 4 times the rate of white women. And in like where I represent the Chicago area is 6 to 1 times the rate. And Native women in the state of Washington is 8 times the rate. So we started off with the Mamas Act, but we could not get that passed. And part of the Mamas Act was expanding Medicaid to the full postpartum period of 1 year. Right now, it's just 2 months. And so, so many women are affected by that. So we worked really hard. We couldn't get the Mamas Act passed, which has its different components. But so we pulled this part out, the Helping Moms Act, to deal with those women on Medicaid, which is about 50%, maybe a little bit more, of the women having babies. So if, you know, things don't just happen the day they have the baby or even 2 months later, there are a number of things that happen 3 months, 4 months, 8 months after a baby is born. So we wanted to make sure that they had access to their healthcare, to their doctors.
I mean, the 60 days after you have a child are not a time period when you want to be navigating the complexities of insurance coverage. I mean, you really need support.
Definitely. And, you know, and it's also a way sometimes women that have babies feel very isolated and people don't understand them. But this is a way for them to go back to their healthcare provider and talk about any issues they, you know, might have. And that healthcare provider can refer them, you know, to what else they might need. So, I mean, it's very important. I know when I had my children, I lived in Peoria, Illinois. I'm from New York, went to college there. My husband and I stayed there for a while and I had no family around me, absolutely no family. Had never held a baby for more than 5 minutes until I had my daughter. So it could be very isolating and lonely. Luckily, I had a lot of friends, you know, that pitched in and helped. And so I didn't have to worry about that, you know, but a lot of people aren't as fortunate.
And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about resistance that you've encountered along the way. And especially if you think that part of what may be going on here is just the expectations that we have of women generally to make it work, and whether those expectations are especially high for women in communities of color.
You know, until someone even brought the issue to me about maternal mortality about 3 years, maybe a little bit more now, I didn't even realize the statistics of what women, you know, had gone through. I didn't realize that it was safer for me to have my baby, you know, and my baby is 36, than it is for my daughter to have a baby now. You know, I did not realize that. And so Black people in general, you know, Black men, Black women, that we can take more, pain and, you know, and those kind of things. It's always interesting to me that people care about unborn, but once the child is born and their family, they don't seem to care as much. Some people.
the pandemic has just underscored what were huge disparities among different populations, among communities of color in health and well-being that have been there for a long time, exacerbated by the pandemic, disproportionate negative impact of the pandemic on communities of color. And at the same time, over this past summer, there was also a huge uptick in social justice movements, social unrest, taking racism head on, I think in a new way with even new momentum. Do you think that we're going to see new partnerships, public, private, individual citizens coming together to really continue and hopefully bring to a new level of resolution work on addressing racial disparities?
I'm an optimist, so I'm going to say yes. And I received a number of phone calls from government relations folks and lobbyists that we deal with and wanting to know what more they can do. You know, they might have scholarships and things like that, but what more can they do? And one of my friends, he says, love is a verb. Don't tell me you love me, show me you love me. And that's the thing. You know, I want corporate people, hire people of color, hire Black people. Who's in your C-suite, in your boardroom? You know, who are you promoting and nurturing? Those kind of things. And of course, you know, helping HBCUs achieve a higher level, you know, or giving HBCUs the opportunity, you know, at different, you know, working on the vaccine or just different things like that. Like, let's stop talking about it. Let's show. I do think things will be better when I look at all the people that came together after George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. People have come together, and also people of all different hues and ages and everything. So that's fantastic, you know, that's happened. As I said, we have to keep it up. You know, we can't rest because things, you know, aren't stopping, and we need people to pay attention. They've had more role models, you know, which is great. I mean, they could still use more, just like even though the Democratic caucus is very diverse, but when you look overall, we still need more women, you know, running for office.
Well, I really appreciate your pointing out that there are collaborations that are happening that don't make it into the mainstream media.
Definitely. I am thrilled. And, you know, there's other pieces of legislation that other members are, you know, working on. But this, I think you referred to it earlier, is a foundational piece of the legislation. We're hoping to look at best practices because the same thing, you know, doesn't happen all over. Another important thing is diversifying the healthcare pipeline. In many studies that you do better when it's someone that either looks like you or understands the reality, you know, of your situation. So there's more work to do.
More work to do, but what a step forward. Well, definitely. Congresswoman Kelly, is there anything else you'd like to share with people listening or anything else you'd like to talk about, either that we already touched on or perhaps that we didn't get to talk about? I'll give you the floor.
I just want to thank all the people that came out and voted. We need people to be active citizens, and one way is voting. But after you do vote and you pick who you want and whoever wins, wins, please stay active. You know, ask questions, meet with us, give us your opinion. We don't have all the ideas and all the solutions. We want to hear from you. And that's on every level of government, you know, from your, if you have a library board or a school board, municipal, whatever it is, please, it's really, really important to stay active. But active citizenry makes for a better community, you know, in my opinion. Be active and respectful. I'll throw that part in.
I love the sentiment of active citizenry, and whether that be in participating in government and influencing decisions that people in government make, or even being an active participant in trying to curb the virus through, as you said, wearing a mask, social distancing, washing your hands. Congresswoman Kelly, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. Be sure to come back next time.